ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 22, Text Number 9. Naiva lakshayate loko. Naiva lakshayate loko. Lokan paryatato. Piyan. Lokan paryatato piyan yata sarvadrisham sarva yata sarvadrisham sarva atmanam ye sya hetava atmanam ye sya hetava Naiva lakshayate loko Lokan paryatato piyan Yata sarvadrisham sarva Atmanam yesya hetava Naiva lakshayate loko Lokan paryatato piyan Yata sarvadrisham sarva Atmanam yesya hetava Naiva lakshayate loko Lokan paryatato piyan Yata sarvadrisham sarva Atmanam yesya hetava Ladies, Na, not. Eva, thus. Lakshayate, can see. Loka, people. Lokan, all planets. Paryatata, traveling. Api, although. Yan, whom. Yata, as much as Sarvadrisham, the super soul, Sarve, in all, Atmanam, within everyone, yea, those, Asya, of the cosmic manifestation, Hetava, causes. Translation. Prithu Maharaj continued, although you are traveling in all planetary systems, people cannot know you, just as they cannot know the super soul, even though, although he is within everyone's heart as the witness of everything. Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva cannot understand the super soul. Purport. In the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is said, Muhyanti Yat Suraya. Great demigods like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Indra, and Chandra are sometimes bewildered trying to understand the personality, the supreme personality of Godhead. It so happened that when Krishna was present on this planet, Lord Brahma and King Indra also mistook him. And what to speak of great yogis or jnanis who conclude that the absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, is impersonal. In the same way, great personalities and Vaishnavas like the four Kumaras are also invisible to ordinary persons, although they are traveling all over the universe in different planetary systems. When Sanatana Goswami went to see Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he could not be recognized by Chandrasekhar Acharya. The conclusion is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is situated in everyone's heart, and his pure devotees, the Vaishnavas, are also traveling all over the world. But those who are under the modes of material nature cannot understand the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of this cosmic manifestation, or the Vaishnavas. It is said, therefore, that one cannot see the Supreme Personality of Godhead or a Vaishnava with these material eyes. One has to purify his senses and engage in the service of the Lord. Then gradually one can realize who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and who is a Vaishnava. So please repeat the translation. Prithu Maharaj continued, although you are traveling in all planetary systems, people cannot know you, just as they cannot know the super soul. Although he is within everyone's heart as the witness of everything. Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva cannot understand the super soul. Amagyanata Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuram Ritam Jaina Tasma Shri Gaurave Namaha Shri Jitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svabadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jigatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorange Radhe Vrindavanishvare Vrishabhanu Sutta Devi Panamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vyayvacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivas Adi Gaur Bhakta Vinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, Srila Prabhupada is explaining here how both the Supreme Lord and the Vaishnavas cannot be seen by those under the influence of the three modes of material nature. In Bhagavad Gita, in one of the purports, he explains, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna and his plenary portions cannot be understood by mental speculation, nor by the non-devotees. If anyone wants to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he has to take to pure devotional service under the guidance of a pure devotee. Otherwise, the truth of the Personality of Godhead will always be hidden. So I always found it, it's like a kind of a contradiction, how this is the most secret of all secrets, this knowledge we have. It's a secret, and yet you can go to the bookshop and you can buy all the books. You know, you just lay down the money and you get all the books. So what are you buying? You know, if it's a secret, then how is it a secret if you can just buy the books and get it and just read it? So of course we understand that the books will only be revealed to us when we get the mercy of the pure devotees. And although a person may get the books and learn them parrot fashion, they may be able to read every, you know, some people have photographic memories and they can just capture everything and then repeat it. But even though a person's repeated it, it doesn't mean to say they've understood any of it. So in that way it's hidden. So there are different ways in which this characteristic of hiding takes place in the society of devotees. There's kind of two different aspects to it. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada says in the Adi Lila, he says, sometimes great personalities hide themselves. Advanced devotees manifest many bodily transformations, which are symptoms of ecstasy, but one should not imitate them to achieve cheap adoration from the public. So sometimes devotees have this tendency that for various different reasons they feel that they need to chant in seclusion. In Gorakhpur, Prabhupada gave a lecture and he said that devotees should not sit down in a solitary place to chant. They should be engaged in some activities, otherwise they will be attracted by the modes of ignorance and passion. If they just imitate advanced chanting, they simply waste their time. So this is the tendency. Sometimes it's thought that Krishna consciousness is kind of like an inertia. Just like when people kind of hear about spiritual life, one of the first images that people get is like a kind of a yogi sitting in meditation. And people become attracted to that. You know, you've got a lotus flower, you have a yogi sitting there, then maybe some kind of, you know, thing coming from the top of his head, and there's a kind of a blossoming of consciousness. And it all appears to be a very static kind of thing where you just sit down in a bamboo grove, you know, and, you know, the breeze of champaka flowers is wafting through. And, you know, you're just kind of deep in this meditation, experiencing this kind of deep spiritual ecstasy or satisfaction. So it kind of seems to be an inertia. You know, there's not much going on. It's all within. You know, spiritual life comes from within. All these kind of cliches and different kind of sayings come out, and people equate this with spiritual life. But Prabhupada says in Bhagavad Gita, he says, Krishna consciousness is sometimes misunderstood to be inertia. And with such a misunderstanding, often one withdraws to a secluded place to become fully Krishna conscious. But without being trained in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, it's not advisable to chant the holy name of Krishna in a secluded place, where one may acquire only cheap adoration from the innocent public. So sometimes if you go on pilgrimage, if you go up to the Himalayas, I remember going to the Himalayas with Padyatra, and I never saw so many yogis in my whole life. You know, every kind of other kilometer there'll be a yogi or two, and sometimes you come across half a dozen in some grove somewhere. And sometimes there'll be one of them will be standing on one leg, you know, it'll be kind of leaning over a tree with his arms over a branch and standing on one leg. Not quite the full austerity, you know, that Hiranyakashipu did, but something, you know. And then sometimes you'll come across a yogi sitting, there'll be fires all around him in a very hot weather. And like that, you see so many yogis. We eventually got to Badrinath, and I remember when we arrived, we were walking on Padyatra, so you know, you get to see everything slowly as it unfolds. And as we were walking up to Badrinath, as we kind of got at the beginning of the town, there was a line of beggars. They weren't actually beggars, actually. So they were kind of like sadhu beggars, because they all had, you know, various, you know, sadhu attires. You know, there are so many different types of attire that sadhus wear in India. So there was a line of them, and it literally went for maybe 3 or 4 kilometers from the edge of the town right up to the entrance of the temple. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like, there's so many beggars, so many kind of sadhus sitting there. And we were there for a few days, and I began to see how some of the wealthy Indians would come, and they would have a big, big basket of samosas, and they'll go, and they'll go, 1, 2, 3, 4. Like this, they'll walk all the way up to the entrance of the temple, give everyone a samosa. You know, there may be a few family members, so one will give a samosa, one will give a laddu, and another will give a bidi, you know. They were giving bidis out, you know, it's like recognized sadhu paraphernalia, you know. They've got to have bidis too, because, you know, for whatever reason. And they're doing like that, giving bidis, you know. I don't know if the more wealthy people would give out Benson and Hedges or something like that, but anyway, that's going on. So you see so many like these sadhus, and you know, sometimes on Vrajmandal Parikrama also you find groups of sadhus in different parts. There'll be a little grove and maybe 3 or 4 sadhus there. And, you know, people are adoring them, you know, and giving so many donations and things. And it's kind of like the whole process becomes cheapened. You know, they're just, all day long, what do? They just stand there waiting for people to give them money. They're not doing any preaching. You know, maybe they're doing some sadhana in the morning. Even that may be doubtful, whether they're actually doing much sadhana. I remember we stopped in, when we were coming in from Padyatra, we were coming into a place called Dhruvatila. When you come from Mathura and you walk into Vrindavan or into Vraj, sorry, into Vrindavan, you come across a small hill called Dhruvatila. So we stayed there the night. And one devotee, we didn't actually stay at Dhruvatila, we stayed down the road. But one devotee told me there's this really sweet little hill where Dhruva Maharaj did his meditation. Would you like to come and see it? So I went with him to this place. And there's this, it's amazing because it's all kind of flat around there. You've got the Mathura Road and there's a few kind of little dotted buildings. At least this was back then. I don't know what it's like now. And you go into this forest and then all of a sudden there's a hill. You're not expecting it, but there's a little hill in the middle of the forest. And you go up the hill and there's this little temple on the top. And inside that temple is the place where Dhruva Maharaj performed austerities. And there are many sadhus there. So we went up there. And there was this little kind of group of sadhus, looked like they were a kind of a sort of an association. There was a kind of, they looked like they were all friends or something. And some of them were cooking milk and doing different things. But I didn't really see anyone doing any kind of much sadhana. So like this, there are so many people that they adopt the dress of sadhus, some wild and wonderful kinds of tilak and dreadlocks and red cloth and tridents and so many things, trying to get cheap adoration. But Prabhupada is saying that actually it's like a waste of time. They're wasting their time. A devotee thinks that, oh yes, you know, chanting the holy name, this is the most important thing. Sometimes we hear the holy name is everything. There is nothing but the holy name. So a new devotee comes along and thinks, yes, there's nothing but the holy name. Let me just go off into a quiet place, chant the holy name. And in this way, gradually, because of the fact that they're still covered by the modes of material nature, the desire for name and fame and adoration is still there. And because people think, oh, there's a sadhu, then they kind of get, they get this, they end up in a kind of a complete waste of time where they're getting some adoration for nothing. Even here sometimes, I mean, a couple of times I've been sitting in the temple room, just chanting my japa after Mangal Arati, and all of a sudden, some old Indian Mataji will come down and put their hands on your feet and kind of, you know, like this, and you're really very embarrassed, you know, because, you know, why are they doing that? But for them, sadhu, you're a sadhu, and they're doing what their duty, you know. So there are many simple people in India who, as soon as they see the dress of sadhu, immediately, oh, sadhu baba, and they'll try and get blessings. So it's easy, actually, if you know the tricks, it's easy to get this cheap adoration. So that's why we have, why Srila Prabhupada introduced in our society this whole aspect of devotional service, that we need many things to do, because we can't just sit and chant. Even somebody who tries to sincerely sit and chant, not looking for adoration and distinction, will find it very difficult to do that. I was hearing a lecture from Ravindra Sarup Prabhu the other day, And he was describing how at one point he decided that he wanted to try and chant 64 rounds a day. So I don't remember where, I think it was in Vrindavan. He went to Vrindavan and he sat down to chant 64 rounds. And he was saying that before Mangalarti, I think he did 16 rounds. Then after Mangalarti, he did 16 rounds. And then after that period was over, he did 32 rounds like that in a go. And he was saying that when you actually sit down and decide, okay, now I'm going to chant 64 rounds, suddenly you discover this great challenge from the mind. Because the mind doesn't want to surrender to just hearing the name. I mean, we probably, most of us, at least I know, that just chanting 16 rounds is difficult enough to get the mind to just focus on the name and not think of other things. What to speak of when you know that you've got 64 rounds to do? You know, 16 rounds is just a quarter of it. Then you suddenly, the mind becomes a real challenge, and you suddenly become aware of actually what you've got to deal with, of how strong the mind is and how persistent it is. And especially if you've decided that you're going to chant 64 rounds for a period of days or weeks, then you know that you've got a long struggle ahead. So it's actually when you really try to surrender to chanting the name continuously, it's actually a great challenge. And when I heard that, I was thinking to myself, before I'd never really had so much attraction to chanting 64 rounds. But when I heard this explanation from Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, I thought to myself, actually, that's a very interesting thing to do, to actually see what the challenge is and see how difficult it is and actually see if you can actually face up to the challenge and really absorb in the chanting. So it's not recommended for neophyte devotees. We have to have been purified. The whole idea is that when you try to chant in the beginning, because we lack purification, the modes of nature sweep over us and we become bewildered. So we have to go through this process of engaging in devotional service. And for different people, there will be different rates of success or different rates of improvement. Every one of us has an individual nature. Some people may become very purified very quickly, and others it may take a long time. So Srila Prabhupada gave us so many different types of engagement, so many different types of devotional service, so many different ways in which we can be active. And of course, when we understand that there are four kinds of people, devotees can engage in every activity from the most humble activity to the most elevated and intelligent activity. And depending on our nature, we can find a spot. We can find an occupation or an engagement which is best for us. So this is one kind of situation where devotees shouldn't try to kind of quickly or, what's the word, artificially appear to be a sadhu, and then the danger of adoration and distinction is coming. So then we get the situation where devotees who are very advanced deliberately hide themselves. On the one side, you've got the neophyte devotee who wants to get attention, and he thinks he's going to get it by pretending to be renounced. And then you've got people who are actually renounced who do the opposite. They try and make people think that they're actually just ordinary, nothing to be interested in. So there's the story of Jatabharata. Jatabharata, he had decided in that birth that he wanted to have nothing to do with material life. He'd already had the experience in his previous life of becoming attached to a deer. And because of the fact that he was an advanced devotee, as in that body of the deer, he was able to remember his previous life of sadhana. And so as a deer, he continued to engage in that sadhana life in any way he could. But then when he took his next birth, he realized the danger. He'd already been, you know, in this previous life, before the deer's birth, he'd already been engaged in a whole life of sadhana and spiritual practice. And even though he had done that, he had to take birth as a deer. So in this next life as a human, he thought, that's it. No, I'm not going to take any kind of risks. I am just going to completely, internally remember the Lord, and externally, I'm just going to have nothing to do with anybody. So he was looking like some kind of crazy man, just wandering around naked, dirty, smelly, sometimes just lying in a heap. People would make fun of him. Children would, disrespect him. And then one day King Rahugana is coming along in his palanquin, and he needs a palanquin carrier. And they see this Jatabharata, although he was kind of crazy, he was very strongly built. And they thought, oh, he'll be perfect for carrying the palanquin. So they drafted him in to carry the palanquin. So he starts to carry the palanquin. But then as he's walking along, he sees ants, many ants on the road. And he doesn't want to step on the ants. So he starts jumping to avoid the ants. And so King Rahugana is there in his palanquin. What's going on? So then he kind of jumps out and says, "What's?" And everyone points to Jatabharata, and it was him. So then he starts to chastise him. He's chastising Jatabharata. "Who do you think you are, you fool, like this?" And then suddenly, Jatabharata, he starts to speak transcendental knowledge to King Rahugana. And somehow or another, Rahugana has this Sukriti that he's able to recognize what is being spoken. And he becomes shocked that actually this person who I've recruited as a palanquin carrier is actually an extremely elevated and advanced devotee. So when King Rahugana realized this, he started to speak to Jatabharata, and he said, "My dear sir, it appears that the influence of your great spiritual knowledge is hidden. Factually, you are bereft of all material association and fully absorbed in the thought of the Supreme. Consequently, you are unlimitedly advanced in spiritual knowledge. Please tell me why you are wandering around like a dullard. O great saintly person, you have spoken words approved by the yogic process, but it is not possible for us to understand what you have said. Therefore, kindly explain it." So I quite like this statement that the king makes when he says, "Factually, you are bereft of all material association." And normally, this word bereft, when you look in the dictionary, bereavement means that you're kind of feeling some loss. Suddenly something's been taken away from you, and you're feeling great sadness because something's been taken away from you. But in this particular instance, bereft means that there's not a trace of material association. It's just completely absent. Jatabharata is just not acting on the material platform. He's having nothing to do with anybody. It's as if he's not in this world. He's actually in another world. In his mind, he's absorbed in Krishna consciousness, and his body happens to be here. So he was deliberately, when conditioned souls in this material world, as we're growing up, we learn how to develop a kind of persona. We project a kind of an image of ourselves that we want people to see. And especially in this age of media, where you've got cameras and videos and things, people start to kind of act for the camera. They kind of put on an impression, only take my, this is my good side, this is my good side. So everyone kind of, they have their sort of image that they want to project. And this is all due to association with material understanding, with material life, so many material considerations. Considering that I am the body and concerned about how people will perceive my body. And because of that, this is because we are actually attached to this material interaction. But Jatabharata, he's just completely cancelled that out. He's not interested in any kind of material interaction. He doesn't care about material interaction. In fact, he knows that material interaction is the cause of everyone's downfall. He wants to have nothing to do with it. And so in this way, he is just acting like this crazy guy. And he doesn't mind. Even the children were passing urine on him. Doesn't mind. So free from false ego that anyone could do anything, and he doesn't mind. But when the opportunity arose, when Krishna sent King Rahugana, who, due to previous activities, had this Sukriti to meet this pure devotee, then, because King Rahugana could benefit from transcendental knowledge, then Jatabharata began, he actually started to make an association, he made a link. But his link was simply to draw someone out of the material world and bring them into his spiritual reality. So this is the way of the very advanced devotees. they sometimes hide themselves like this. And Rahugana, he realized that he'd been very insensitive, and also he'd been blind to reality. So Prabhupada describes this in Bhagavad Gita. He says, deluded by the three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, the whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. Purport, the whole world is enchanted by the three modes of material nature. Those who are bewildered by these three modes cannot understand that transcendental to this material nature is the Supreme Lord Krishna. So this is the problem, is the three modes of material nature. Sometimes I remember first joining, you know, and you hear a devotee, someone will say, you know, are you okay, Prabhu? And he says, oh, I'm really in the modes today, Prabhu. You know, and I always thought that was kind of like a funny thing, you know, in the modes. What does that mean, you know, in the modes? These modes of nature, you can't see them. You know, it's like they're like air. You know, you can't see them anywhere. There's no kind of symptoms. You know, there's no meter on the forehead. You know, there's like goodness, passion, and ignorance. And you can kind of figure it out. You look in the mirror today, oh, I'm much more ignorance than today, even more goodness. It's like a mysterious thing. It's like a, you know, hidden thing. And the amazing thing about these modes is that as conditioned souls, we're all covered by them to one degree or another. And that covering is like a blanket. It obscures the reality. We think that we know what we're doing. You know, we rationalize. Yeah, I've understood. I've read this book. I read that book. I heard this from this devotee. I got chastised by that devotee. You know, my status at this time, you know, I have this much advancement. You know, I'm not bad. I'm not, you know, maybe I'm not like a pure devotee, but I'm also not like that rascal fool over there who's just a complete Kanishta, you know. At least I'm, you know, somewhere up here. And we're convinced that what we know is correct and good. But sometimes, you know, we may be propounding some philosophy. We may be preaching to somebody, and a more senior devotee may hear us preaching or speaking in some way. And then they may say, well, actually, you've made a mistake. This is not the way it is. And then they may inject us with some information that we've never heard before. So a neophyte will go, you know, will just kind of dismiss it or somehow or another make it seem as if they've understood, but actually not understand, just kind of try and brush it off. But actually we should be prepared to accept that maybe there's something that I don't know. Maybe there's something that I missed. Maybe there is some aspect of Krishna consciousness that I've misunderstood. So we need to be prepared to, at every moment actually, although we have to preach with conviction, but if a senior person comes in and challenges us with some other information, we need to be open to that and examine that and compare it. You know, go back and read the books and see, is this actually a fact? And oftentimes we may be surprised to find that we've had a misunderstanding for many years. Some aspect of the philosophy we've misunderstood for many years. And this suddenly has been revealed to us, this difference. So we can see that King Rahugana, you know, he was acting like this in this way. And he was completely blind to what was going on around him. So then he says, Prabhupada writes this in Srimad Bhagavatam, he says, King Rahugana was very repentant because he had forced Jadabara to carry his palanquin. He therefore began offering prayers to all kinds of brahmanas and self-realized persons, even though they might be playing like children or hiding in some guises. The four kumaras walked everywhere in the guise of five-year-old boys. And similarly, there are many brahmanas, knowers of Brahman, who traverse the globe either as young men, children, or avadutas. Being puffed up due to their position, the royal dynasties generally offend these great personalities. Therefore, King Rahugana began to offer his respectful obeisances unto them, so that the offensive royal dynasties might not glide down into hellish condition. If one offends a great personality, the supreme personality of Godhead does not excuse one, although the great personalities themselves might not take offense. So Jadabharata, you know, he's recognizing his position, and he's saying that Or Prabhupada is saying that being puffed up due to their position, the royal dynasties offend these great personalities. I was thinking how actually today, almost everyone is thinking they've got some kind of royal blood. You know, it's like, you know, actually there's a big trend in the internet now to look up your ancestors. And I guess everyone's hoping that they're linked to some king or queen somewhere. You know, they're all kind of hoping they're going to be, you know, some royal, so they can say, oh yes, I'm actually descended from some royal blood, you know. And then in this way increase their prestige, you know. And of course some people, I saw one documentary one time where one TV personality had traced his ancestry and found out that his ancestors were like these really kind of, you know, low shudras, you know. And someone was asking him, you know, are you disappointed? He's going, no, I'm not disappointed, you know. But you could see he was a little disappointed. So nowadays, actually, you know, nobody has any respect anymore. There's very little respect in the world. I met one devotee five years ago, when I was back in the West. One devotee came to help us with a project we were doing. And he had joined ISKCON when he was about 15 or 16. When I met him, he was about 20 or 22. And he was telling me about how in the UK, there are many kind of, there's this phenomenon of gang, kind of gangster, you know, young teenagers getting into gangs and you know, forming these gangs. And you've got like you had in America, the Bloods and the Crips, you know, these different gangs are there. So in England also, you've got these different gangs. And one of the things they have is like, you know, got to show me some respect, mate. You know, want some respect, all right? You know, and there's like, there's this thing of, you know, you got to, you know, I am who I am, and I want some respect. You know, and it's like, it's a phenomenon, you know, to be a gang member, you know, the more powerful a gang member is, the more respect you demand from everyone, you know. Get down, you know, and they'll bash your heads together if you don't offer that kind of respect. It's like a complete perversion of what actual respect should be. So this is the situation, you know, people have kind of degenerated so much that they're, for no reason at all, expecting respect, even though they don't deserve any. So it's got to the point where, you know, in Kali Yuga, society is so bereft of any even understanding of what respect is. So therefore, we're in a very dangerous situation. And especially, like, many of our, you know, many of the generation of my age, for instance, I'm like 50, and, you know, when I grew up, there was at least a semblance of kind of decency in the family. You know, we would sit down and have meals together, and, you know, we'd go on holiday together. But now you hear that kids, they come home, and, you know, there's a note on the fridge, you know, dinner's in the fridge, and everyone just comes in and just helps themselves to whatever's in the fridge whenever they feel like it. It's kind of, it's called, it's like when cows graze, you know. So nowadays the family eating systems are called like grazing systems, where you kind of just go and graze on the fridge whenever you feel hungry. You know, you just go to the fridge, take something out, and eat it in front of your computer. So everyone like that nowadays. There was a study that I was reading that was saying that the amount of meaningful interaction that the average parent has with his child is something like 7 minutes a day. And part of that is, can you pass the salt, please, you know, John? You know, that's like, you know, part of the meaningful interaction that they're getting, you know. But most of the time, the parents are at work, the kids come home, they've got a key to the house, they go in, let themselves in. There's no meaningful interaction. Social kind of, you know, the social norms which are passed down from parents to children, that whole disciplic kind of system has ceased. And children nowadays get their social norms from what they see on TV, which is why they're all turning into gangsters. Because TV is just glorifying gangs and gangsters. The music is glorifying gangs and gangsters, and the working class kids just get into that. So, whereas Rahugana here, he's, you know, recognizing that actually the pure devotees, they often appear in guises. They often appear in hidden forms, as children, you know, as avadutas, apparently crazy people. So in this way we can understand that it's not so easy to see the pure devotees. You know, sometimes we may join ISKCON and we may be looking around and we're looking at the senior devotees and we're thinking, well, that one looks like he could be pure, but I heard that, you know, he has this kind of situation, but that one over there, you know, is definitely kind of, you know, grey hair and bushy eyebrows, you know, could possibly be spiritual. And sometimes we get a case where we'll get groups of hundreds of devotees are worshipping one devotee, and they're all saying that he's the pure Mahabhagavata. And then suddenly it becomes revealed that he's not, and he leaves ISKCON. So you've got some groups of devotees are convinced that their guru or one devotee in ISKCON is the most elevated pure devotee, and everyone else is just like, you know, third grade. And then all of a sudden the situation can be reversed, because the person you're thinking is third grade maybe are hiding themselves. The great personalities hide themselves. They adopt guises. So once this has become clear to us, once we've analyzed this intellectually, that you can't actually see the pure devotees necessarily. Prabhupada describes that sometimes pure devotees will advertise themselves. He says, but they do that in service to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So like, for instance, our Srila Prabhupada, although he didn't say, I'm a pure devotee, you know, come and worship me. But at the same time, with his intimate devotees, he didn't also deny it. And it became clear, you know, through his activities, etc., that he was a very elevated devotee. And because Prabhupada was following the order of his Guru Maharaj to spread Krishna consciousness around the world, therefore, he needed to, you know, attract people somehow or another, according to their, inclination. So when Prabhupada went to America, you know, he saw that many of the hippies were inclined towards Indian mysticism, towards, you know, the Eastern philosophies. So for Prabhupada, actually, of course, we understand Mahaprabhu must have made the arrangement. He could immediately tap into that kind of vibration, if you like, and attract so many people. So in that way, we can understand that, you know, in some cases, the pure devotees may exhibit themselves, but oftentimes they don't. Oftentimes because they don't want cheap adoration. Just like Prabhupada warned the young devotees, if you do this, you'll just get some cheap adoration. And sometimes they do it for the cheap adoration. But the pure devotees, they don't want that cheap adoration. They're disgusted with cheap adoration. Cheap adoration gets you nowhere. It's just a waste of time. People just trying to get some kind of, what's the word, score some points, but actually useless. So, like that, the pure devotees hide themselves. So then there's another thing to consider. We understand that we have to become prideless. This is one of the important aspects of Krishna consciousness. The false ego tends to make us proud, and we need to develop an attitude of pridelessness. But sometimes our pride arises from our associations. Sometimes we try to gain the favor and association of an advanced person, so that then people will see, oh, he's with that advanced person, he must also be very advanced. You know, by the association of an advanced person, we try to kind of, you know, what's the word, scrape off some of that adoration. You know, oh, this is a close associate, you know. Oh, this person is a very close associate of such and such sadhu. Oh, very nice. So, Gaugavinda Maharaj, he spoke of this sometimes. And he said, he actually quoted Sanatan Goswami. Srila Sanatan Goswami said, Gopayad Gurum Atmanau. One should hide one's guru. He's advising devotees to go deeper in their relationship with guru by basing that relationship on following the instructions their guru has given about service and bhajan. He went on to say, historically, the sadhu samaj, the society of saintly Vaishnavas, has never been impressed with mere external shows of devotion. They are moved, however, when they see genuine Vaishnava humility and other good qualities that have manifest in a devotee due to that devotee's dedication to the instructions and bhajan given by guru. Introspective devotees prefer to keep their guru hidden and glorify him by exhibiting exemplary behavior. So, of course, this is more difficult to do. It's much more easy to say, my guru Maharaj is the best. You know, he's just so pure. I mean, you just have to just, you know, like, this is the kind of sentimental approach sometimes, where people just kind of wax lyrical about their... And of course, it's good to praise the spiritual master like that. It's good to have these good thoughts about him. But better to exhibit exemplary behavior ourselves, to actually be very humble and pure ourselves, to be so humble that we don't expect any respect, and yet we're ready to serve everyone else. When we come across devotees like that, sometimes, you know, like for instance, Gopi Pranadan Prabhu recently left his body. And almost everybody was glorifying how humble he was. And how even when people would glorify him, his face would have this painful look of embarrassment. And everyone could recognize that, you know, this person actually deserves so much praise. And yet when you try to praise him, he looks like he's so embarrassed, as if, why are you doing this to me, you know? So it's like, when we come across devotees who are extremely humble, and yet at the same time extremely dedicated and devoted and learned, we become impressed by that. And actually, oftentimes we want to serve such a person. This is what happened in the Srila Prabhupada's case. Prabhupada came to the West, and everyone immediately recognized that Prabhupada has come just to serve us. In fact, in the beginning, that's all he ever did. He just served the devotees. He cooked for them. He cleaned up after them. He did everything for the devotees. And the devotees saw, this person has come, you know, this is actually a great saintly person, and yet here he is, cooking for us, cleaning up after us. And then they started to want to serve him. So this is actually the way to glorify our guru. Rather than just, you know, expressing great flowery words, but in ourselves, in a sense, kind of basking in the fact that because we can say this, we must also be a very advanced devotee, because we recognized this advanced devotee. So, okay, one more little story from, this is something that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati wrote. He said, one day Srila Gaurakishore was sitting in his bhajan kutir in Sri Navadip, chanting Hare Krishna very loudly. Other persons who had assembled there were also chanting. At this time, one person came and began to display different emotional symptoms, such as crying. Some devotees began to think that that person had attained the highest stage of devotional ecstasy by chanting the glories of the Lord. Srila Gaurakishore immediately requested that person to leave. Some of the persons assembled there became disturbed at seeing this and also left. Srila Gaurakishore then said, one who has actually attained love of Godhead will never display the symptoms, but will always keep them hidden from the general people. Just as a chaste wife becomes very embarrassed when she has to show any part of her body and thus keeps her body very thoroughly covered. In the same way, when one has real devotion unto the Supreme Lord and becomes elevated to love of Godhead, he always feels embarrassed to exhibit the symptoms of ecstasy and thus always keeps such symptoms unmanifest. So like that, there are these different aspects of to consider regarding displaying different moods, and we're given a lot of caution that on one side we should be open to understanding that, to the understanding that anyone actually can be pure. Someone we may think is just a nonsense, maybe deliberately appearing to be a nonsense to distract us, to distract our attention, and maybe actually they're actually very elevated. If we think like that, that will make us very cautious and we'll be less likely to commit offenses. When we understand that this is actually a phenomenon which goes on with extremely advanced people, they don't want cheap praise and therefore they hide themselves, then we can be very cautious and we can understand that we have to actually get mercy. We have to pray for mercy so that the Lord will reveal to us who the devotees are. It's not that we can never recognize them. If the Lord has mercy on us, he'll reveal them to us. So they are actually, just like Jatabharata, when the right moment came, he revealed himself. These devotees will reveal themselves to people who need that, who feel a need. They feel a deep craving for enlightenment, for help in Krishna consciousness. Krishna sees that in our hearts. And just as Krishna guided King Rahugana, he guided his palanquin through a particular field where Jatabharata was. In the same way, if we really need help, then Krishna will give us that help in the most unexpected place. You know? I don't have time, there's another story, but I don't have time to get into it now. But in unexpected places, the mercy can suddenly appear before us, and then that can be the one thing which changes our life, which convinces us that we have to change our ways and actually become completely dedicated to the pure life. So is there any comments or questions?
Yeah.
Cheap praise or expensive praise?
Seems like they don't want cheap praise, but they do want praise.
Yeah, well, of course, the praise, they're thinking that the praise is very great, right? The person who is, you know, trying to get praise, when someone comes and praises him, you know, they're great. This is exactly what I wanted. You know, this is fantastic. So they're assigning value to it, but actually, it's nothing. You know, they're just going to go to hell with that praise. So in that sense, it's cheap. You know what I mean? The praise is not real. It's just some external characteristic, but it has no basis to it. Whereas, you know, somebody who actually has, you know, who's not trying to, who doesn't want this cheap praise, then, you know, if you praise them, it's actually great value. That's real value. I've got a couple of things here. I guess I should read these first. Okay. All right. This is just a notice I've got to give. Any more questions or comments? Yes, probably.
We have a situation in which a devotee is looking for a guru, so he has to know if somebody's qualified. So here we're hearing that, well, there's a verse, unless you're a pure devotee, you can't understand who's a pure devotee. So then one could say, well, till you're a pure devotee, you won't really know who's a qualified guru, so you're not qualified to find one. The other side of that, it seems, that I want to put this, you could discuss and see what you have to say about this, then the devotee will say, but in his presence, I feel inspired. So therefore, it's kind of like, maybe I can't understand it, but I experience it. So is that valid? Is that a valid way, if you really can't see, is this person pure or not, but in his association I'm advancing? Is that valid? Or could that just be because you like him so much, you think you're advancing? Maybe you could discuss that.
Okay. Well, from what I've understood, just as Krishna explains how when a person is crying for him, when a person, you know, in material life, we hear this when we first come to the movement, that when eventually you start to question what's going on in the material life, how can I get out of this? There must be some way. You look for God. You search for God. The Lord sees in your heart that you're actually searching for Him. And then He sends the devotee to you. So in this way, if a person is sincerely looking for help, they're you know, realizing that they're in a desperate situation, that they have no good qualities themselves, and they just need help, they're crying for help, then Krishna will send help. Now, there's a place in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Srila Prabhupada speaks about how one should take initiation from an Uttamadhikari, but sometimes one may take initiation from a Madhyamadhikari or a Kanishthadhikari. He says, you should understand that you can only rise as far as they are. So for instance, it may be like for many of us, and myself included, I remember when I first joined, all the devotees, it was mentioned the other day, all the devotees seem to be the most wonderful people, the most elevated devotees. And for many years, we may just need the association and help of someone who's in a lower level of Krishna consciousness. That may be the best we can do, the best we can aspire for. So in that way, it may be for an entire lifetime we may have a guru who's a Kanishtha guru. And that will help us, definitely. But of course, because of the fact that we don't have to rely only on Diksha, because of the fact that we're, you know, our line is a Shiksha line and Shiksha gurus are there all the time, eventually it may become apparent, as in our movement, for instance, where the devotee, where a guru leaves, all of a sudden you've got, you know, your guru's gone. What are you going to do? But because you still have sincerity, you can find someone who gives you shiksha. And in that way, again, you know, begin that or continue that path of elevation in Krishna consciousness. So, again, I mean, I remember when I first joined, I was initiated by Jayatirtha. And when I was called down for initiation, I was actually completely in Maya. I mean, I was 17 years old. And, you know, I was kind of just a very whimsical young brahmachari. And, you know, I had grown some hair. And the thing is that in those days, we were just told, this is your guru, and you're getting initiated on this date. You know, you didn't really have a choice in the matter. He was the guru for England, and, you know, that's it. So I was told, you know, okay, you're getting initiated on Sunday. you know, be there. So on Sunday, I had hair, you know, so I came down from an inch because I didn't want to shave up because I was attached to my hair. I used to have really long hair, but at this point it was only like a quarter of an inch or something. But I was attached to it. And I came down for initiation, and they said to me, shave up! Get up there and shave up! So I was like, so I went upstairs and shaved up. So I didn't take initiation from the best, you know, consciousness. You know, I was really not very surrendered. And later on, you know, Jayatirtha left, and so many unfortunate things happened to him. And at a certain point, actually, I was invited, you know, why don't you come and be with Guru Maharaj and leave ISKCON and, you know, do what we're doing, you know, and you should have faith in Guru Maharaj and, you know, like this. And I was kind of, he'd named me Shyamakund. And I always wanted to go to Shyamakund. And he was in India and he was telling everyone to come. And the devotees at Bhaktivinoda Manor were selling everything they could to send devotees to India. So I had this opportunity to go to Radhakund, Shyamakund, you know. But somehow or another, I thought to myself, because I joined before Jayatirtha, before I joined when Prabhupada was still there, and I knew ISKCON under Prabhupada, and I kind of thought to myself, I can't just go on the strength of this one person, even though he's my guru. If everyone else, all the other devotees were telling me, you should stay. So I stayed, I didn't go. And then later on, you know, I was grateful that I did that, because the devotees that went with Jayatirtha went completely crazy. So somehow or another, I kind of got some protection. So I think that like that, devotees, if we're really sincere, then even though we may take shelter of someone who later on proves themselves to be not the highest, still we can make advancement in Krishna consciousness, still the process can go on. And like you said, you know, somebody who, they're inspired by a person, but it might be because of the way they look or etc., etc. Again, it's like, as long as we're in the process of Krishna consciousness, following the regulative principles, chanting our rounds, engaging in association of devotees, even if we are attracted to someone because of some external symptom, the fact that we're doing the right things and we've got this internal drive for the truth will cover for us. And even, you know, we've seen it. So many devotees have taken shelter of people who left the movement, but they still stayed in the movement and gradually are advancing. So in that way, the other side is, of course, we have to become educated in these kinds of understandings that actually we can't see who's the sadhu. So if we can't see, what are we going to do? If we can't actually make a rational choice, what do? The only alternative is actually to become pure. And if we become pure and cry and pray to Krishna, then he reveals. He says, this one, you know, and like that. So it's like, it's in that sense, that's the secret, isn't it? It's like, that's the mysticism, that's the secret in Krishna consciousness, is that actually to one who really wants it, Krishna will give it. Nothing can come between that. Doesn't matter how many gurus fall down, if you sincerely want Krishna, there's nothing that can come between the soul and Krishna. There's no obstacle. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, the devotees say that there's no reason for any kind of pessimism in Krishna consciousness. Everything is positive in Krishna consciousness. There's no room for pessimism. Because of the fact that nothing can become between the jiva and Krishna, if the jiva is sincere. But otherwise, it's the cheater and the cheated. You know, if we're really kind of insincere, just like I was in my first initiation, I got cheated. I recognize it now. I didn't deserve initiation. I sat there and took initiation. And then later on, that person left. So it's like, I got what I deserved, you know, really. You know, I mean, if Prabhupada had initiated me, what a nonsense disciple he would have had for such a long period of time. So, you know, Prabhupada was saved from that misfortune. Okay, so we better stop, it's getting late. Oh, one thing, announcement. Today is His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj's Vyasa Puja Tithi, and so his disciples will be serving breakfast prasadam on the ground floor. So you'll all be greeted with the sight of breakfast prasadam as you go down. This Prabhuji is almost... Oh, you better go quick. God, I'm sorry. I've caused you to fast unnecessarily. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.